evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts, arts and entertainment in our region, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we'll hear from Christopher Gross about the Blue Jay Jazz Festival, running Thursdays through August 24th at Sky Park at Santa's Village. We'll also have Ben Perper in conversation with comedian and author John Pates. We'll start tonight with a reminder of Celebration of Music, a talent contest and TV program coming to the Inland Empire soon. The show was conceptualized by Gene Bortnick and his son, PBS sensation Ethan Bortnick. Lillian Vasquez has more.
Ethan Bortnick has been around the public television audience for quite some time, started at the age of 8. And now we're going to speak with Gene Bortnick, producer of a new show that's coming to the Inland Empire. It's going to be called Celebration of Music. So excited to hear about this new project, Celebration of Music. What's the concept and what are you hoping to do?
Well, we're excited about it, too, because of a few reasons. Number one, and most importantly, I saw as a father that Ethan was given the opportunity through public television and through the different avenues to be able to share his music with many, many people, you know, around the country in terms of millions of people. We're now filming, you know, just filmed his third national PBS show. And the ability for him to be able to share music is incredible without all of the sort of commercial hype and really the things that take away from the true meaning of sharing music. So what he had an idea was, and we put it together, was why don't we celebrate music? Why don't we celebrate the local folks, the kids, whether it's an 8-year-old or a 20-year-old who wants to share music in a true way? And this will be a talent search in a different way, where we will be able to have children, teens, and young adults from all over your area will be given opportunity to live out sort of their dream, to perform live on stage and then also on television. So that is sort of the basics of the show, where we will ask folks to submit their talent, whether it's performing on an instrument or singing or a cappella groups or a full choir or a band or, you know, whatever the music they want to perform, they will be able to perform it on this show. And then at the end of the day, one winner will be picked. He or she or the group will perform one or two solos at a live show. And then once that happens, everybody who was involved will perform with a finale on stage in front of thousands of people.
Wow, that's a great opportunity, especially for our youngsters right here in the Inland Empire. Now, what is the age range that can participate?
We can go anywhere from small children to teens to young adults. So whether you're in elementary school, middle school, high school, or college or university, you can apply for this. You can be a solo artist by yourself, or you can be in a group, whether small or large. It really depends on what music you want to share with everyone in your area. They will go on a website that we will give you, which is called celebrationofmusic.com, and they will pick KVCR as the station and the area. They will then submit their name, some information they'll need. A short video will be submitted. And then once all those videos are collected, a team of panelists, vocal coaches, people in the industry, will pick the top 12 or 16 or 18, depending on how much time we'll have on the show, who will then perform on television. And out of those 12 or 18 or whatever we pick, all of them will be at the concert in Riverside, where we're going to do the concert with you all. The winner will be announced that night.
Okay, so the competition, like, if you narrow it down to 12 or 18, however many, they'll come on like a weekly show and do a competition weekly in our KVCR studio?
Yes, what they'll do is every show will feature between 4 and 6 individuals or groups. They will be performing. They will be interviewed by Ethan. They will be given some suggestions. There will be mentors on with them to be able to give them suggestions. And every week we will have a different group of people. When this is all said and done, everybody who has competed will also be able to be at the concert where we will announce who got the most votes and most interaction online. And that individual or group will be performing live at Riverside.
Wow. You and Ethan came up with the premise. What was your reasoning and your drive other than to share talent and present more talent? What were some of your other things that you felt like this is really something we need to do?
One of the things is we saw that some schools, you know, even cut music programs, whether it's choir or band or anything like that, and there's really no one supporting it. By having KBCR support this program and this series, it is critical because even if education is cut, this will allow kids to have a motivation to practice, to perform, to say, hey, this is the end goal. I want to be on television. I want to be on this show. I want to perform in front of people. And this is the opportunity that we're giving them to be able to do that. So that was a really critical part of it because of the lack of music education and abilities and opportunities for children to be able to perform. And that's really one. And number two, we've seen a lot of these talent shows, which are great to watch. They're entertaining and fun, but a lot of them focus more on the drama of the person, what happened to them, why, you know, more of the drama portion of it. We don't want to do that. What we want to do is really give these kids the opportunity, the time slot to be able to share music. It doesn't matter if they had a hard time in life or they had an easy time in life. It's more about allowing them to share music. So those two reasons is really the main focus of why we even started thinking about doing this.
That's Gene Bortnick in conversation with Lillian Vasquez. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, also at kvcrnews.org.
One of the things that I think that's really cool about the project is that on the public television side, it's different than the public radio side, our audience is female 55 plus. We have the kids when they're young and they're watching PBS Kids, and then they leave us for a while because it's maybe not as cool to watch public television. And then they come back as young adults who have their kids who let them watch public television because they trust it. And then they leave us again and they come back when they're around 50. So what I like about this project is the idea of not only local content, which is really awesome and showcasing some of the talent that we have right here in the Inland Empire, but maybe younger people watching public television.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things Ethan started talking about to me and saying, look, he loves the audiences that come to the live concerts. It's an older audience and families come and there are kids and teens that come and they know his music. Then they start following. But we are not able to get those teens to watch for many reasons. But this show can have the ability to have kids not only perform, but also get involved through social. So, for example, let's say there is an incredibly talented violin player from a local high school. That high school, we hope, will then, and all their friends, get behind that contestant, both social media-wise, getting on Facebook, getting on Instagram, getting on Snapchat, and really giving that person the support. So through social media, through allowing them to share the music that they get connected to, I think we're going to have a much younger viewing audience, and they're going to be engaged into the arts.
Well, I think that's a great opportunity. Now, will it be a voting thing, or will judges decide, you know, like some of the other shows, we know that, let's just say Dancing with the Stars, it's also fan-based, and a lot of the votes count in conjunction with ability to dance. So how will it work for this?
Ethan will be hosting the show, and we will have a couple what we call mentors. Ethan's very careful. He doesn't want to use the word judges because he wants to share his experience. He also wants mentors to be able to give advice. The voting process will be online where people can vote for that person, but the decision will not be only by the voting process. It will also be with the interaction process. How many people, for example, online suggested what the next song the person should sing? How many people got involved? There's going to be a lot of interaction online after they're on television. So based on that interaction, based on the votes, based on the amount of videos they post after the initial television appearance, based on all of that, a winner will then be decided on a formula that we have established here. We want to keep it on a local basis for the initial show, and then finally all the winners from all the local regions to take that nationally. And whoever wins that will then tour with Ethan for a 20 or 30 city tour. The markets that we're doing it with, of course, KBCR are such incredible partners, and we have one in the Midwest that we're starting with.
So let's talk about Ethan's new public television special.
The name of the new special is called Generations of Music. So it's Ethan Bortnick, live in concert, Generations of Music. It spans many, many generations of music, from Beethoven to Sinatra to Coldplay. It focuses on how music can span generation, influence generations. And we had an incredible icon from the group Peter, Paul, and Mary, Peter Yarrow, come in and tell some of his stories about how he was on the march with Martin Luther King and how that song, Blowing in the Wind, affected, you know, millions and millions of people, and how the music can affect so many different generations. And then as a symbol to that, his daughter came out to also sing and talked about how music affects different generations. The audience were, you know, everyone from 2-year-olds to 102-year-olds, and really, really captured how music has affected different generations and will in the future.
When we talk about generations of music, Gene mentioned Frank Sinatra. How is it for you when you have such a plethora of songs in your head? Were you able to narrow it down to, and how did you decide on the selection of the songs that will be played for this particular concert?
So it really started with me and my musical director, Dave Rosenthal, who also worked on the last special with me and has been working with me for a little while now. And Dave and I really sat down and thought about what should the theme of this special be. And something that I've been able to see, not only traveling a lot, but seeing the PBS audience, and that it's all generations of people. You know, you see families come to the show. You see little kids. You see, you know, older people. You see everybody at the shows and watching the special. And seeing that, we decided to obviously have the theme of this special be generations of music. And so when we were picking the songs, we really thought about not only songs, but music that has really inspired and influenced and affected lots of generations of people. Music that has been enjoyed by all ages. And so when it came down to those final songs, it was tough. We wanted to do so many songs, but at the end of the day, it came down to what really inspired a lot of different ages of people.
We've been speaking with Gene Bortnick, producer of Celebration of Music, which will be a competition show that will be on our PBS station right here in the Inland Empire, and Ethan Bortnick, who is a longtime PBS celebrity performer on many public television stations across the nation, who has been performing since about the age of 3, but on public television, maybe 9 years old. Is that when you did your first one, Ethan?
Yeah, 9 years old.
Well, Ethan, it's been a pleasure. You're all grown up. Your answers have changed so much since the first time I interviewed you when you were 9 years old. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Lillian. I'm very excited to do the Celebrations of Music. It's going to be phenomenal. Thank you for letting us be a part of the amazing community down there. It's going to be great.
Thank you. We look forward to your visit when you record the show. Take care.
Thank you. We'll see you soon.
That's KVCR's Lillian Vasquez in conversation with Gene and Ethan Bortnick. More information at celebrationofmusic.com. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Also at kvcrnews.org. Just ahead, Ben Perper in conversation with comedian and author John Pate. Later in the program, we'll find out more about the upcoming Blue Jay Jazz Festival. That's at Sky Park in Savage Village. Listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Also at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Later in the program, we'll hear about the upcoming Blue Jay Jazz Festival. That's at Sky Park at Santa's Village. First, though, you may have caught him on American Parlor Songbook. Author and comedian John Pate. KVCR's Ben Perper has more.
You're originally from Alabama before you made the move out to SoCal. Why did you decide to come to California?
For the specific purpose of doing stand-up comedy and acting and writing.
What was the comedy scene in SoCal like in those days?
It was huge at that time. I came in 77, and from that point, from 77 to about 1992, was really the comedy heyday. All of the big places were out here, and whenever you were to watch The Tonight Show or The Merv Griffin Show or The Dinah Shore Show or any of those, they would always have people on the show, the comics who were performing at the Comedy Store and the Improvisation. And so I saw that back in Alabama, and I would say, and he'll be appearing at the Ice House and the Comedy Store and the Improv. And they would rattle off the dates. And when you hear Merv Griffin or Johnny Carson say that, you go, wow, I want to do that. I want to perform there. So I came with the full intention of being a comic. And first place I walked into, the Comedy Store, they gave us an audition night, and I started going to the audition night, and within roughly about 6 months, I was a regular performer there. And at that time, there weren't that many working or professional performing comics from coast to coast. There were maybe 400 or 500. Now there are probably 15,000 comics. But at that time, it was a really It was a small class of people, a small group of comics, and I got in a really fortunate time.
Is that place still there, the Comedy Store in Los Angeles?
Comedy Store is on Sunset Boulevard. In fact, if you go and you drive by and you look on the front window, you'll see my name right next to Robin Williams.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nice. Baptist Press did a story about you in the 90s, which talked about being a Christian comedian in a field where there weren't too many of those. How did that influence your comedy?
Well, it didn't really affect me one way or the other, because here's an adage that I got from the head of entertainment at the Riviera Hotel when he first hired me. And he was asked about it. He said, well, this guy, he's a clean comic. How does that go over in the casinos? And the guy said, hey, funny is funny. Paige just happens to be clean and funny. And in fact, he even went on to be on the TV show The Sopranos, Steve Sciarippa. And so I appreciated that when he said it. But at the same time, I always felt like if you do clean material, you're going to be able to work forever. A lot of the guys, they kind of limit themselves to just working clubs because they can't work on TV. They can't work on family cruise ships. They can't work in different venues. I got a lot of work because I was a clean comic. There were many years that I worked for CBS for two TV shows, Designing Women and Evening Shade, as their warm-up artist. And they had a studio audience there. They would bring their families for the show, and they're big tourist crowds. So they wanted a clean comic. So it really helped in the long run that you work clean.
Yeah, definitely. One of the people you dedicate your book to is Red Skelton. What was your relationship with Red, and how did he shape your comedy?
Well, that was really one of those things where you land at a point of destiny, because I couldn't have worked it out myself. I really, as a kid, all I wanted to do was meet Red Skelton. Mm-hmm. I thought he was the best, funniest comic and actor and entertainer of all time. I worked toward it, gear my act toward just kind of mimicking and relating to him and family entertainment. And it just so happened that I was working in Las Vegas, and I was walking over to the Hilton Hotel where they had a Red Skelton gallery, an art gallery with a lot of his artwork. And the owner of the gallery, he said, are you a Red Skelton fan? I said, yeah, I'm performing across the street. Do you want to come to the show? So he came to the show that night, and then after the show was over, he said, we're doing a show with Red. Would you like to be on the show with him? And I said, are you kidding? All I want to do is meet the guy. Wow, this is great. Yes, of course I'll do it. Mm-hmm. And so I flew back to Las Vegas to do the show with him. And then after the show, both Red and his wife complimented me during the show. And then after the show, he and his wife talked with me for about 15 minutes. And from that point on, from 1991 until 1997, when he passed away, he would always request me to be his opening act. I was in heaven, you know, just to be able to not only meet the guy, but to be able to work with him for so long.
Yeah, so you got 6 years of basically opening for your mentor.
And the great thing was that I got a lot of lessons from him. I would ask him questions. I would quiz him at the airport or when we were on the plane or riding around somewhere. And he just gave me probably the best advice of anybody that I've ever met. Now, right now, we have a big exhibit of Red Skelton's artwork in Riverside at the Downtown Art Gallery, the CBU Art Gallery. And his wife came to the opening reception for that. Mrs. Skelton is still alive, and she's a wonderful person. And so we have a lot of his artwork there dedicated to his legacy and his memory.
That's at the CBU Gallery?
At the CBU Gallery down on Main Street in Riverside. And it'll run through August the 31st.
That's John Pate in conversation with KVCR's Ben Perper. JohnPateComedy.com for more. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Also at kvcrnews.org.
So you've also worked with the likes of Jay Leno, Robin Williams, as you said, Jerry Seinfeld. Do you have any memorable stories about any of them?
Well, being able to work out on the road with Jay, and again, that this is going to go back to the clean comedy thing. Mm-hmm. Jay would always tell everybody when he first started out that his goal was to be in television. And because of that, he had to keep his act clean. And he hated following a dirty opening act. And when you would work the comedy clubs, you really had no say as to who you worked with until you got to a status like a Jay Leno or a David Letterman or somebody like that. So there were about three or four people that he requested to be his opening act, and I was one of those people. I got to work with him in a lot of places, in San Jose and down in Newport Beach and in Oklahoma City and different places. He would ask for me to be his opening act because he hated following somebody dirty. He felt like if I have to take 15 minutes to work to get the crowd back on my side and make them forget what they just heard, then I've lost 15 minutes of my act. So he just really appreciated the fact that that I was a clean comic. And we would, after the shows were over and stuff, even out on the road, there would be club owners that would want Jay to go out with them to a bar or something. And he didn't like to do that. He would kind of use me as an excuse. He would say, me and Pate, we're going to go back to the hotel. We're going to play video games.
Yeah.
But he just didn't like doing those types of things because he was working toward a goal. And of course, he achieved that goal. It was great. Now, I do have a funny story about working with David Letterman. We were working out in the San Fernando Valley, and we actually stopped to get dinner at this little burger place one time, and the guy behind the counter immediately recognized Dave because he had already been on The Tonight Show and stuff. And the guy behind the counter was really nervous about getting his order, and so he pushed the order out in front of Dave, and he said, Mr. Letterman, sorry about this, but we burned your French fries, so we gave you some extra. And Dave turned to me and he said, ooh, just what I wanted, more burned French fries. And, of course, the guy behind the counter, he kind of shrugged, but it was one of those things that Dave would later use as a joke in his act. But just little tidbits like that of things that would happen on the road were, it was an experience that I always remember because of these guys that I worked with.
Yeah. Any chance you'll be invited to do Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee with Jerry Seinfeld?
I doubt it, even though I get to talk to Jerry through different people because he works with a lot of the same guys that I do. And I'll always say, oh, tell Jerry I said hi. And even he's my Facebook friend, but I don't ever get any messages from him or anything. I just kind of keep track of what he's been doing and stuff. But I doubt very seriously if I'm going to be on that show anytime soon. You got to have notoriety and somebody that they can recognize, and I'm not to that level.
Okay. Do you still do stand-up comedy these days? You mentioned that you did festivals.
I still do it in the summertime. I just did a one night. I was at the Rampart Hotel in Las Vegas 2.5 weeks ago. And so I'll do that usually once in the summertime and once at Christmas break. But because of my teaching schedule, I don't get to go and do the extended engagements anymore.
Yeah. Do you have any upcoming performances?
Probably not until December, because I've already done the one in the summertime. They usually bring me back about every 6 months or so.
Great.
Now, I take that back. I have periodically, and I still get invited to do a show here at NPR, the American Parlor Songbook. Mm-hmm. And so they'll use me to do stand-up and comedy on that. And I've done about four of them so far. And J.P. Houston, who's incredible, he uses me a lot on that show.
Yeah, you were here, what, 2 months ago?
About 2 months ago, yeah. Mm-hmm. We did one here in the studio, and hopefully I'll be able to do that again in 2 or 3 more months.
So aside from a long career as a comedian, actor, writer, etc., you're also a part-time professor at Cal State San Bernardino. How did you find your way into academia?
That was very interesting. Because I was doing the warm-ups for the TV shows, it took me off the road. And the road circuit at the time, during the late 80s and early 90s, there were a lot of clubs in a lot of different places. And when they offered me the job of working with Designing Women in Evening Shade, one filmed on Tuesday night and one filmed on Thursday night. So that kept me in town. But I was only working 2 nights a week. And it left all of my days free. So I decided to go back to Cal State LA and get my graduate degree. And when I did, I saw two little notices on the job board there. One was for Azusa Pacific University, and one was for Cal State San Bernardino. And I said, well, I'll apply for these and see if I get one of them. Well, I got both. And the great thing was that I just kind of traded one audience for another audience, an academic audience for an entertainment audience. And so I started teaching part-time and was able to convey the same communication techniques and skills and stage presence and those types of things that you have to have. And it really tied in well with communication aspects, so I really enjoyed it. And so I just kept doing it. After the run of the TV shows, kind of when the shows were at the end of their run, I couldn't go back out on the road that much anymore because a lot of the comedy clubs in the mid-90s started to dry up. Television was saturated with comedy, and as a result, there wasn't really that trendy nature of comics at comedy clubs anymore. Even though I still go and do concerts in Las Vegas in the summertime and things, I don't really do comedy clubs anymore. So I just enjoy that from August until June doing the academic stuff.
Yeah. So speaking of academics, I found this video online of a song you recorded called One Day When You Swing That Skillet. And most of the comments are something along the lines of, that's my comm teacher, or that's my professor at San Bernardino. Do you show that video in class often?
No, I don't. But when students hear that I'm a comic, they'll immediately go and search my name on YouTube, and that video will pop up. That song, not only does it haunt me, but it, in the sense that it was a great song. Yeah. It was a country song, and I was doing it as a joke in my act, and I was performing down in Nashville one time. Just the song title, One Day When You Swing That Skillet, My Face Ain't Gonna Be There, was a punchline for a joke. So I did it on stage, and then after the show was over, this guy comes up to me and he hands me his card, and he says, I'm Mike Borchetta, Borchetta Music, here in Nashville. Do you actually have a song by that title? And I just kind of looked around. And I said, yeah, I do. So I came back to California, and I wrote the song, and a friend of mine did all the music on the song. He plays 12 instruments. He's a genius musician. His name is John Jorgensen, but he's an incredible guitarist, but he plays a lot of other instruments. So we put the song out with he, myself, and another friend of mine, Dick Hardwick. And the song ended up having a better career than I did at the time because it started getting a lot of airplay. And this was back when we had vinyl. Mm-hmm. Sold a lot of copies of the album and the single. And then somebody got the bright idea to make the video back in 1985 when MTV was in its infancy at the time. So even though the quality is one of those really old music videos, it still haunts me because the kids found it on YouTube.
Yeah, definitely. And that's you singing in it, right?
Oh,
that's
yeah.
Your voice?
Yeah, that's me singing it.
Nice. Yeah, great. By the way, you have a 4.4 on Rate My Professor, which is pretty good.
Oh, well, so even better. I don't go to see it. I don't read the comments or anything. But if Rate My Professor says so, then I'm happy about it.
Yeah. No, so it's it's serving you well still.
Well, everybody knows I love my wife. She's as sweet as she can be. Oh, but she's got a knack for getting her way that don't feel so good to me. Well, honey, I'm tired and I can't take no more. I'm black and blue and my head is sore. Things go dark and I hit the floor and you don't feel sorry for me.
One day when you swing that skillet, my face ain't gonna be there. One day when you throw that rolling pin, it ain't gonna part my hair.
Well, you can throw a tantrum, throw a fit, or when you throw that toaster, it's time to quit.
When you swing that skillet, my face ain't gonna be there.
That's John Pate, conversation with KVCR's Ben Perper. JohnPateComedy.com for more. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR, also at KVCRnews.org. As KVC Arts continues, we'll find out more about the upcoming Blue Jay Jazz Festival, running Thursdays through August 24th.
For Lee King and Sam King, the King Brothers!
There are several ways to get more information and tickets. I recently spoke with Christopher Gross on the board with the Blue Jay Jazz Festival.
For the festival, it's best to go to bluejayjazz.com. For one thing, it's much easier to remember, and that's where all of the festival information is. The Blue Jay Jazz Foundation is the overriding umbrella organization, nonprofit, and most of that website is about the education program, how to donate, the history, and so forth, with just a link back to the other one when you want to talk about the festival.
Is there a Facebook presence by chance on
yes.
this as well?
We okay, have a Facebook, cool. Instagram, and Twitter account with activity decreasing in that order.
Okay.
Facebook, it's just facebook.com/bluejayjazz. Instagram, it is instagram.com/bluejayjazzfest, F-E-S-T. And Twitter is twitter.com/bjjfmusic.
So the festival, it's actually three consecutive Thursdays. We're going to be talking, by the way, a little bit about Sky Park at Santa's Village, the Blue Jay Jazz Festival, and a bit about the Blue Jay Jazz Foundation. Let's actually start with the Blue Jay Jazz Foundation. Tell me what you can about this group coming together, the whys and whens of it all.
Well, the foundation, as a nonprofit 501c3 education organization, was launched in 2007. It came out of about another decade previous of jazz concerts being presented in Blue Jay, the idea of the parking lot. In 2002 and 2003, there was a couple of jazz events put out there in the meadow by Sky Park, which at that point it was Santa's Village. So that was kind of loosely done. There were some great artists that came up to the mountains and played in those days since 2007. But the foundation itself was founded to provide education support through instrument lending for the high school students who, you know, they run out of instruments before the kids can get one. So we have a pretty large supply of instruments that have been donated by people who no longer have the chops to, to do anything with them. And they bring them by. They're stored at one of our board members' dentist's office. And throughout the year, if somebody is in need of an instrument, whether they're a high school student or just wanting to play, really, and can sign the loan agreement, they can take the instrument with them. On the other end of that, feeding into it, are people who have instruments and no longer play them. They can get a tax donation for giving them to us, and then we have people who will refurbish them if need be. And for the students, if something goes wrong, if a pad comes off your saxophone key or the reeds go away, we'll replace those too.
The Adopt an Instrument program, and the way to get more information on something on that, that would actually be then bluejayjazzfoundation.org, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
And let me also say the other major initiative that the foundation has is a scholarship program. One of the main ones involves the Rotary Club of Lake Arrowhead, which annually provides scholarships sort of in partnership with us to high school students that have been particularly outstanding. And then we have some other ones with other groups and on our own that we give out too. So there's, you know, up to a half a dozen or more given throughout the year. In fact, the two scholarships this year that went out to graduating high school students will be given out by Rotary at the August 24th concert with Adriana Marie.
Nice. So this year it's at Sky Park at Santa's Village. So we'll come back to the festival itself, but first let's talk about where it's at. In essence, it's sort of a return home, but we'll get to that in just a bit. Tell us about Sky Park at Santa's Village. This is something that some will remember, and for others, it's something that they know of as something that just opened last year.
Yeah, there's a lot of people. I think their only memory of visiting the mountains up here might have been going to Santa's Village in the past. It opened in 1955, coincidentally the same year as Disneyland. That's how long ago it was actually founded. But it went out of business in 1998. And after that point, it was a site where we piled up bark beetles, destroyed logs, and things like that. And Bill and Michelle Johnson, local business people, got involved a couple of years ago and were able to give it a complete facelift. I would guess that it even surpasses anything it had been in the past. And have nice restaurants in there, have a lot of eco-friendly rides and so forth. Nothing is powered. Everything is human pedaled and so forth throughout this park. It's really beautiful in there. So that opened in December of last year. So they were there for the Christmas season last year.
What kind of rides are up there?
Well, there's pedal car go-karts, and they're working on kind of a monorail that will be, I believe, pedal powered. That one isn't open yet. And then there's going to be a bike trail, so there's going to be fly fishing in the meadow. I think that they've even hosted some classes for fly fishing, which the marketing director is particularly excited about.
Nice,
as a fly fisherman. So there's a whole bunch of stuff, and there's several restaurants in there, and yeah, it's really rejuvenated a lot of this. And it's just a few miles east of Lake Arrowhead, past a little town called Sky Forest, on the way to Big Bear. So it's right out on the rim as well, which is kind of cool. It's, you know, you get to have that feeling of driving along the mountain edge, which some people are nervous
about.
One of our musicians actually said that he has to wear a bag over his head when he gets driven up here.
Yes.
But nah, don't, you know, you still got to stay in the lane wherever you're driving, I figure so.
Sure.
Keep your eyes on the road.
I do have to ask, just to clarify, Sky Park at Santa's Village is a year-round place.
It is. Okay. It is year-round. Yes. That's right. Exactly.
Santa's Village.
During the summer, there's summer-type events, and it's going there full-time now. Their website is skyparksantasvillage.com.
Okay.
Sky Park Santa's Village. So people can go there, and they can also buy tickets to this. We have some pre-arranged dinners that they can order, and those are also available through there for the festival. But okay. Yeah, that's a year-round thing, and of course, when the winter comes and there's snow and there's Santa's, all of the places that are called Mrs. Claus's Kitchen, you know, they start to make a lot more sense in December than they do in July.
Yeah. That one did deserve clarification. Santa's Village does kind of imply a Christmassy kind of thing there. So
the fact that it's Sky Park, that's completely new to the whole Santa's Village. It's one unit. It's just that the name Sky Park was brought in this time, which gives it that year-round outdoors image as opposed to it being just something to do when Sugar Plum Fairies are dancing in your head or whatever. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's go to the Blue Jay Jazz Festival now. The press release says that it's an annual event. Talk to me a little bit about the history of the festival. First of all, it seems like the foundation came out of the festival, not the festival coming out of the foundation. Is that right?
Yeah, I'd say that's an accurate genesis. The first time there was a jazz event was in Blue Jay, and there was a restaurateur named Pat Welsh who ran the famous Royal Oak restaurant over there in Blue Jay. And he was also a musician, and he had jazz-playing friends. And in that first year, back in 1995 or 1999, somewhere back in the 90s, he got some of his friends together and just had a jam session several nights during the summer. You know, he had some pretty famous friends. And that first paid event was one where the Tonight Show Orchestra with Tommy Newsom, Young, and Ed Shaughnessy, those guys, came out and played and had a good time and basically were just promoting their band. And it caught on, it kind of got traction from there, and it became to where people expected it, and it got better and better, and the Arrowhead Arts Association, which is a major group up here putting on now classical and pop music, they got involved for a few years, and then in around 2005, 2006, it basically shifted to where the Arrowhead Arts pulled out, and business people came in, and then it became obvious that someone needed a clear plan of how to make this ongoing, an education component was created. The whole idea of education about jazz is quite widespread. I mean, it goes beyond what happens in the classroom. And this year we've actually tried to do a lot of that with our programs.
Yeah, I understand that Bill and Michelle, you were just talking about Bill and Michelle Johnson, they actually have fond memories of coming to the festival when it was just in the meadow, just outside of the village.
Yeah, they were one of the families who used to go there before 98, and a lot of people, they remembered it from childhood. A lot of people even remember going to a jazz concert there those 2 years when it was in the meadow outside Santa's Village. Back when Santa's Village was shuttered, they still put together a jazz show out there in that meadow, which the meadow is still there, and they've done more with it now. The Johnson's have really cleaned it up and made it much more usable with fly fishing and bike paths and so on. Yeah, a lot of people remember going out there. I may remember it. I have foggy memories at this point.
Okay.
But yeah, it's a lot of people. That's all I know about the San Bernardino Mountains is going up to Santa's Village and going home.
That's Blue Jay Jazz Foundation board member Christopher Gross. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Also at kvcrnews.org. I understand this is a thing that you can bring your own food, but what other food options? You mentioned restaurants. What sort of thing will be going on when the music is playing?
Well, sort of a general caveat and on our part is that this is our first time that they're putting on a jazz festival or letting us put on our jazz festival there. It's also the first time that we've done it at a venue like this. From 2007 through 2016, the summer festival was done in Blue Jay in a parking lot above the drugstore.
Right, yes.
So everything was trucked in that was used, all the food and so forth. So we have restaurants there. And what the Johnsons and Sky Park have done is offered to have some boxed meals ready for people when they show up if they order them in advance.
Okay.
So that's sort of the principal kind of food that's going to be there offered. And we do sell tables, though I will say right now we've sold out tables for the August 10th concert. The second two concerts have tables. But for those who purchased tables before today, concierge will bring the food out to those tables. But anybody can have food, whether they just get a single ticket, they can just sit in their chair and eat these box meals, or they can bring their own stuff. It's kind of a tradition to bring your own picnic basket and bring a bottle of wine and all that, and that's still part of the deal, whether you're at the table or whether you're just in a single ticket.
Yeah. Nice.
So food is a big part of it for people. The show starts at 6:45. If you don't want to do all that, you just want to come and not have to have napkins with you, just show up, you know, by 6:30 and just listen to you.
Eat at home, just bring wine.
Just bring wine.
Yeah, cool. Okay. So this is on three consecutive Thursdays, August 10th, 17th, and 24th. First of all, was there any discussion as to doing this on a Thursday? Is this by chance so that it didn't compete with the Lake Arrowhead Village Summer Concert Series, Fridays and Saturdays?
Well, it was so it wouldn't compete with certain things, but not so much the village concerts. There are a lot of activities up here, and there are a lot of organizations and so forth, so Thursday seemed like a pretty safe day when we wouldn't have competition. Also, they did try Saturdays in one of the previous couple of years, and it wasn't as successful as Thursdays were, so we went back to Thursday. Yeah, that's kind of where that has stayed at this point.
Okay. Well, now let's talk about the bands that are performing. It's a different band each of these three Thursdays. This is a bit of awkward phrasing, so depending on when folks are catching this interview, A person can see these guys tomorrow or will have just missed them. So August 10th will be the King Brothers Blues Band. That's Sam and Lee King. Tell me more about these guys.
King Brothers came out of the Bay Area, Oakland blues group. They are actually related to Freddie King.
Oh, wow.
And okay. We have a nice blog story on our website about how they actually connected with him, which is worth reading. I won't go into that whole thing. But yeah, he actually ended up helping launch their careers because one of the brothers was down in L.A. and met him, and turned out that Freddie King was going to play a big important show at the Fillmore in San Francisco and needed a backup band, and they ended up being it and touring with him, and that's how they got off the ground. So they've done a lot of important shows over the years and are really still a real powerhouse group. They play their kind of blues. They have three other guys with them. Lee is the guitarist and the lead singer, and Sam is the drummer. It's great to have them.
The next thing is this close to Soul with a capital S, Greg Adams and East Bay Soul. This one is exciting. Talk to us about this guy, the band that he came from, and what we're going to be getting. This one is going to be Thursday, August 17th.
Yeah, Greg Adams is a trumpet player, and he was in Tower of Power for 25 years. Tower of Power is going to be celebrating its 50th anniversary in 2018, and so Greg was with them for over half their life. He's also from the Bay Area, and he grew up the son of a pair of Salvation Army ministers who were also in the Salvation Army band. So he had band, brass band music in his childhood. And he became a star at high school. His teacher said he was good enough that his teacher said, you know what, Greg, you just run the jazz band. I'm going to go work in my office, and if you have any problems, come to me. And he got so good at arranging, he was going to go to Berkeley back in Boston. And Emilio Castillo, the leader of Tower of Power, heard about him because he was gigging with some bands up there at that time. He got his musician's union card when he was 16 and was playing in bars and stuff.
He was playing in bars before he was old enough to get into bars.
Yeah, yeah.
Nice.
And yeah, he said, yeah, I grew a mustache. I said, yeah, that ought to fool him. He's not that tall either. But in any case, Emilio and Deep Kupka heard about him, and they auditioned him, and he joined the band. And he had a knack for arranging, and he basically was the guy who, from the very first Tower Power album, was creating that horn section part. So fast forward to now, he has a band again with five horns up front and a rhythm section and a lead singer. So it isn't Tower Power, because he has specifically said he wanted to move it forward, but it incorporates a lot of what that was about. And of course, Tower Power pretty much does original material.
Right.
And while Greg writes songs and other band members write songs, you know, they'll do old soul numbers and Motown and
good.
You know, Al Green songs and Marvin Gaye. That's really what they're about. Greg, when he first left Tower of Power, his first album on Epic was called Hidden Agenda, and he did a cover of a Sade song, which went to number one. It was 5 weeks at number one. So his solo career got off to a hot start back in the heyday of smooth jazz, contemporary jazz, and he's just been a touring and recording fixture ever since then, and arranging for people, too. He's done something like 1,000 recording sessions. A lot of times as arranger, and the guy who was kind of responsible for getting the horns arranged when the Tower of Power played on Elton John albums and Linda Ronstadt albums, and Huey Lewis albums, Little Feet albums and all that stuff.
They became the Memphis Horns of the West Coast, you could say.
They really did, yeah. And they played all over the country and recorded a lot up in the Bay. In Sausalito, there was a recording studio where people would fly out to have them do their sessions with them. He's been a big part of that sound for a long time now.
Then the final date is Adriana Marie and her Groove Cutters. This is another one that I'd be excited to see. I don't know if this is legend or lore, but I read that she just left home with just the guitar in her hand and came out to California. Or is that just sort of a Bob Dylan?
Well, that's pretty romantic. And I have never interrogated her on it, but that's definitely part of her bio. Her father and mother had been part of a group called the Carol Lee Singers back in the 60s, a folk group that traveled up and down the East Coast. And so she was familiar with performing. I mean, she was like a showbiz kid going back and forth. And she also had an interest in theater, musical theater, singing from the time she could do any of those things, you know, get up and walk. So she was ready to start a career as a singer. Her dad was a professor out here at Long Beach, so she came out, went to school there. She's basically been singing all her life. It was a few years ago that she met L.A. Jones. Both of them are from Connecticut, but they had never known each other before that. And she was actually attending an Albert King Memorial Anniversary concert. She walked in the door, and he was on stage with his band. And that's how they met. They have this great sound that puts together sort of the 30s, 40s swing jazz, show tune aesthetic that she comes from, along with blues, which she also is an expert at, with L.A. Jones's focus, which is definitely Chicago blues, and the music Muddy Waters played, and T-Bone Walker. So they brought that together. So they've got horns in their band, and they write a lot of their own material and do a lot of covers of old blues and the swing era stuff. It's a unique sound. They've really honed in on this particular kind of sound. That'll be a great night.
That's really cool. I've been checking them out, in all honesty, and they do have more of a, I would have to say, a genuine swing sound. That is, it does feel like something from the 30s or so, as opposed to the, quote, swing revival that happened in, say, 95, 6, 7.
Yes, as she said, they don't try to be a novelty act. They go back to where that was real, not some aftershave.
So we've got the Rim of the World High School Jazz Band coming in with Adriana Marie and her Groove Cutters. That one is August 24th, wrapping it up. To wrap this up, let's go through the websites and points of contact, whether it's just for more information or to track down tickets. Are tickets available only online, or are there stores around Blue Jay?
They're only available online or at Sky Park, or by phone at Sky Park. The Sky Park admissions office is where you can buy up tickets over the phone, and that is 909-744-9373. You could call Sky Park and order them on the phone if you don't want to do it online, or you can order them online at either of the websites, or you could buy them in person.
So then for Sky Park, that one is skyparksantasvillage.com. Then the Blue Jay Jazz Festival, that one is simply bluejayjazz.com. For tickets and for more information on this, I want to say this upcoming event, but it's three upcoming events. This is really great.
Yeah, it really is. So it's three Thursdays. It's great for locals up here and for anybody down the hill, as we say. Those of us who live up here, it's no big deal to drive up, but if you're going to only do it one or two times, it would be one of those Thursdays. It would be great. And just to point out that we've sold out all the tables for the King Brothers, but the other two, there's plenty of room.
So entry is still fine on the 10th. It's just that the tables are sold. That one is for August 10th. And as far as August 17th and 24th, there are still tables available and, of course, plenty of other entrants available there. So if you don't have a table, should you bring a chair, a blanket? What's that setting?
No, there are chairs. No, okay, people should not bring any other furniture. No bookcases, no tables, no chairs. We're all set for you. That is asked a lot. It's a concrete floor, and chairs will be arranged in rows, and the tables will be set up with 8 chairs each, so it'll be all ready to go.
That's Blue Jay Jazz Foundation board member Christopher Gross. Again, the Blue Jay Jazz Festival runs Thursdays through August 24th.
Yes, at the Kingdom of Swing.
And that's just about going to wrap up another edition of KBC Arts. Thanks again to Christopher Gross, John Pate, and Gene Bortnick. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Ben Perper, Mike Pesavento, Jessica Greenwell, and Izzy Gordon. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts, Behind Us Now, for example, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet. So thanks to Sean as well. You can hear past KVC Arts programs via podcast, kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.